an exhibition which I last organized for the Queen's Jubilee in 1977. And I made it again, so I knew there was the background of the lake. I chose the site for it to go on. And I really felt it was a wonderful experience. I was in charge of the whole thing. I was dealing with all these sculptors who are a remarkably cantankerous lot, I might tell you, to deal with. And most of them are continually fighting about whether they were in the right place, and they wouldn't go next to so-and-so, and Tony Caro certainly wasn't going to go next to Kenneth Martin, and Kenneth Martin would pull out if he was next to Tony Caro. But it takes a great deal of energy and persuasiveness to deal with that. But on the other hand, it's a marvelous experience. And I do wish one day you could experience a really big sculpture exhibition over here. I think they're a marvelous place to do it. I think people would love it. Which goes back again to a strange thing where I think my first experience of sculpture in the open took place, and it wasn't sculpture at all. When I was a kid, during the war, the powers that be got it into their heads there might be a massive landing on Portageee Meadow. So all sorts of odds and ends were stuck all over the meadow, including a First World War gun, which had been lurking around in Noble's Park or somewhere like that. And a lot of strange objects were constructed, which actually, when I think back, had I a photograph of them, were made up basically just to stop people landing, but they had a sort of sculptural interest about them. And seeing these weird forms in the field, I suppose, was maybe another beginning of the way one starts, like Colby Cubbon's boat, you know. My main problem, actually, when I did the Battersea show, was that we'd had a drought the year before, and we had to regrass the park. That's a huge Henry Moore in the background, the sheep piece. And the curse of my life were these geese. There were an army of little baby geese, which I wired in. And as soon as the park was opened, as soon as the great day came and we had a royal to open it and all the rest of it, this lot came out, and they literally, within seconds, were rending every blade of grass up in sight and trying to get it back to sort of mud again. That's a piece I made a little bit after that, and I had a show at the Serpentine Gallery. And that now is in Scotland. It's in one of the Scottish sculpture parks in north of Scotland. Usually covered with snow. Now these pieces were, in a way, going back and going forward. They were about shells, things breaking open. They were also about going back to my interest in armor. They were going back to my interest in the flexible joints, the hidden space, and the very special quality you get from certain things touching each other in a certain way. And this is a wall piece coming out of the same series of ideas. They're very much like the articulation of an armadillo's armor, or the sliding mechanism of a camera lens, or some opening or shutting shell. But they also look to me, they relate to me to ancient Celtic art, to the approaches, to the way that the handling of metal there. The metal itself is extremely thin, but in each piece is very carefully fitted in to give the fullest quality. So there's no more, no less to be there. Here again, this one is literally carved out of solid stainless steel. Again, the way it touches, the way it bounces, the quality of it. This is the Armada piece, which is, again, a box-like structure. It's very much like Japanese, the way Japanese armor fits together. And I just love the very simplicity of it. You know, you just I moved these pieces around, these pieces of metal, a thousand times, and then one moment will be a time when you've got it right, and they fit, and they make something which has got a bit of magic about it, and you can't then ever imagine that they could be in any other position. And out of the previous work came the three legs, which is in fact three armored legs. Each leg being having a totally separate entity. How it came about was that I was asked by the Millennium Committee to make a piece of sculpture to commemorate the millennium, and I was given a very short time to make it in. But it was a very interesting technical problem, quite apart from anything else, because in the first place I decided to make the three legs. Instead of being the conventional thing, standing on end, going round like a wheel, I thought all three legs actually were three legs. It was a sort of object, it was alive, a living three legs, which was actually about to move. It was about to get off the ground and maybe begin to turn. And that was the concept behind it. But bronze has no strength. Bronze is a shell. Bronze is... it's brittle. It's basically the perfect bronze. Is a box, is a ball, is a dome. But if you start making it do things, like I'm doing and making it do things here, you're in danger of the thing just falling to pieces. Its own weight, its own the tension, the wind blowing, the forces pushing it and pulling it. So. Inside the three legs is a complete stainless steel skeleton, completely invisible, but without that it wouldn't stand up, and you can't see anything, any of it at all. But I've shown you photographs of my stainless steel chain pieces, my stainless steel mechanical sculptures. In that sculpture is a whole structure like a human anatomy. Running through it with joints which are hidden, each of these sections here. Under that is a stainless steel boot. In the shoe is a stainless steel box running up to here. The joint there runs along there. With a case here with an elaborate fixed joint which runs up here, right up, right to the top. Springing off here, so the case comes off through there, down there, into the ground. So it's got as many bones as my leg has, and or anybody else's. Well, that's what holds it up. And anyway, returning after the battles of the three legs, I continued to work in this method of. And steel, and again and again, I brought the idea of the anatomy of form, of shape, into my work. I mean, there is a good example of quite a massive. You know how satisfactory it is to cut through something and discover a new form, like. Slicing a cabbage, you reveal a wonderful landscape or real sort of new world. Cut a pear in two is an adventure. But to carve through the metal and discover inside unknown shapes and bring that to life bit by bit, so it eventually forms its own persona. What I was trying to do. This is where I began to use lead, wrapping lead around wood. And I made a lot of pieces out of lead. Of course, here, showing you these slides is a bit like the tip of the iceberg, because each one has probably come from a whole series of others. But I didn't want to make you inflict too many on them. A lot of these things, I got increasingly interested in the idea of anatomy at this time. In fact, I call all these pieces the Vesalius pieces, after the famous Renaissance anatomists, these marvelous drawings of the muscles falling off the human body and revealing the structure. It's something which I think is every sculptor must understand. And this is... I wonder if you've guessed what that is. What it is, actually, next to the Royal College of Art Sculpture School, where I spend so much of my time, is the Natural History Museum. In the cellars of the Natural History Museum is the greatest, wonderful, most wonderful collection of odds and ends you've ever seen in your life. The public doesn't go down there. But there I am in there. And this is a sort of extraordinary procession of great beasts. In the foreground, you have the skeleton of a giraffe. Behind him is an endless row of vast, great elephant skeletons. And I spend a great deal of time down there. And around about this period, which is not very long ago, about 1986, I was smashed up in a car accident. I was actually knocked down by a speeding police car and had my leg broken. When I was in hospital for ages, and I hadn't drawn for ages, and I couldn't do very much. So after a bit, I asked somebody to bring me some paper, and I started drawing. The man next door, the awful creature who was driving me crazy by smoking them all over me, and then the nurses, then the trees. When I came out, I thought to myself, well, I've always wanted to draw in the Natural History Museum cellar. I will. So I took myself down there and started. And I've done a great many. In fact, if you saw that exhibition sculpture, you would see the walls were covered with drawings. And these are some of them. Unfortunately, I haven't got a really good collection of the drawing slides. This is a walrus skull. And I find them just so extraordinary. This is a horse, where I've combined the shape and the bits of the skeleton. This was acquired by the Tate, actually, and it's there now. And I was very pleased to get one of my drawings into that collection. A couple of frogs. And I started doing some sculptures about the same sort of ideas, which I'm still working on now, actually. And it's a trout. Little crab. A big one. And it's a tiger. There's an incredible museum full of these things in Paris. This is that man. Can you get really sharp, Jimmy? That's it. That's a monkfish. That's in a fit for him, too. These are some little figurative sculptures I've been working on. They're just for a friend of mine, Philip King. These are just sort of thinking heads. But I'm now more and more working away from the mechanical welded sculpture of the past and into the traditional means of making sculpture, wax, clay. And I returned to the human head that interested me so much in the first place. And that is the last piece. Right. Well, there the slides stop, rather. But I hope that it's given you some idea of the various things I've been doing over the years. And I think when one comes back to the Isle of Man, of course, everyone always says, well, what is the, where's the connection? And where's the connection with the Isle of Man? But I feel there is a very special quality about it coming from this place. I think you are in a way very conscious of the bare hills. I mean, when you come to the island to begin with, and you step off the plane, the place seems to be almost without any identifiable features. But when you actually spend even a short time here, you go down, like the other day when I landed, within minutes I begin to sort of think, well, I know what goes on over that hedge, and down there at Saturn Gorge where I first went into the cave, and then round the corner is the road down to the Scarlet, and that's where my grandmother lived, just by the bridge at Castletown. And the whole place is alive for me, in a way that living in London can never be. And so, really, I suppose, though I don't come physically here, I can go for a walk in the Isle of Man in my head at any time. I can take myself down to the port point of air and suddenly remember the sound of the sea pulling against the shingle there. I can remember being as a child amongst the corn being cut and stooking the corn, the feel, the heat of the Buldoon valleys or down in the Brew below. And I can remember the adventures too. I can remember, for instance, a great cart horse we had. It's called Blossom. Blossom being driven mad by the mayflies, the flies teasing her and biting her. She started running, and she couldn't stop. She ran down and down, and the fields were so fast that she hurtled right down, crashed into the Brew, and I saw her hanging in the Brew. Now, any sculptor never forgets an occasion like that. I remember, too, just walking through the fields and seeing, you know, a dead rook tied up on a stick, blowing in the wind. And these are the sort of the raw material of sculpture. You can get it, it's all around you. And no better place than this. So, thank you for listening and looking at my labors over the years.
Answer questions if anybody would like to put any, but he says that he's a little bit deaf, would you please speak out as loudly as you can?
Sorry, was that influenced by other artists? Well, naturally, one's inevitably influenced by people you know and all the rest of it. But I don't think I was at the beginning particularly interested in what other people had made, my contemporaries. I felt, for instance, when I started making sculpture, particularly in the late 50s, I actually hadn't known any sculptors. I'd known a lot of painters. I thought of myself as a painter. And in fact, I didn't want to know any. The interesting thing was that I soon found I had more in common with and more friends amongst the sculptors than I had ever had amongst the painters, because they seemed to like my paintings. They understood what I was trying to do, because I think the sense of form. But my two greatest friends, actually, was a chap called Hubert Dalwood and George Fullard, both of whom died fairly young. George was particularly a friend of mine, and his work had been essentially based on his experience in the war. He built a series of works around his memories of being building up forts and things out of furniture as a child, and he really made his sculpture ugly. And I think he's a wonderful sculptor, but he was very unfashionable at the time, because during the 60s, the idea of anything which was mostly figurative became incredibly out of fashion, and a lot of the people who actually didn't have a concept of sculpture which could encompass the figure. And I think this has actually been one of the things that has stood me in a great deal of good stead, is my actual understanding and liking of structure and anatomy. Whereas a lot of people who moved in the thought of sculpture in terms of style rather had problems about that period. But I was aware what people are doing, one's contemporaries, but I think I was always pretty determined to stick to my own guns. I wasn't terribly interested in forming part of a group or anything like that. And it's one of the reasons why I particularly like being involved with the Royal College of Art, because it's entirely postgraduate college where we absolutely deal with our students as individuals rather than try to form them into some movement or group or anything like that. And one is constantly surprised by the new ideas which the young people are coming out with. And many of them have become, very famous sculptors like Tony Cragg, David Mack, and many others, quite apart from Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth, who were both at the college years ago. Well, Gonzalez too. I mean, that's interesting. Gonzalez was, in fact, came from a family of blacksmiths, and he was also assistant to Pablo Picasso. And many of his forms, in fact, were, in fact, interpretations of Picasso's drawings and paintings in steel. And of course, he taught Picasso to weld. But if you use steel, and particularly if you forge steel, you are sharing the language of not only of Gonzalez, but of the armorer and the blacksmith. The man who makes a sword or a spear out of hammering a lump of steel is very much in the same, speaking the same language as Gonzalez or whatever. It is a very exciting thing. But I felt myself particularly interested in the volumetric side of the things after a bit. But in a way, it was to escape from the medievalism of welding, of forging, that I took later on to using the idea of purely machine forms. I felt there was a sort of inbuilt romanticism, which I was a little bit suspicious of. But any materials has a history, and particularly now when I'm going back to traditional use of drawing and using bronze and clay and wax, stuff like that, is that in fact I realized in fact that I was never trained as a sculptor, and I missed that bit of my life completely. I didn't go through the traditional and rather sterile teaching that was going on when I was a young student in the sculpture schools, which consisted mostly, I remember the Royal Academy schools extremely well, because you went into the sculpture school and there was a rather glum-looking model surrounded by equally glum-looking students, usually of pretty large size and extreme stupidity, measuring this model inch by inch with a pair of calipers and then transferring it into clay. Nothing ever real came out of it, because it was like an endless preparation for some mid-19th century activity which wasn't going to happen. None of them ever cast anything in bronze. They never made a complete thing. It was a learning process of how to measure, how to scale up, how to scale down. And it was seen to me about the dreariest occupation you could possibly imagine. And of course, every now and then, they created the same sort of what they called an imaginative work. Well, it suited one or two, but I mean, Henry Moore had driven all that out of the art schools years and years ago, but it continued, I'm afraid, in many of the places, and didn't in fact disappear from the art schools until the reconstruction of the art schools in England in about 1960, when for the first time professional artists were allowed into the art schools. And I was part of that. A group of us were appointed by the government to examine the art schools in England. And we went round like the government inspector in Gogol's play, arriving to strike terror into these moribund institutions, and finding, in fact, very bored students being very badly taught by very dreary people. And in fact, we insisted that they would bring in professional artists, that they would have decent equipment, and give the students something to think about, educate them, but give them the idea that they had something to say. In fact, unlike the sort of teaching I had here at Douglas Art School, I might say, which seemed to be about breaking whatever interest you had in the idea of being an artist. I remember, to give a good example, I did a head when I was a student here. And next day I came in, and it had been severely damaged. So Mr. Whitehead, who was then the head of the art school here, came up and stood beside me, and he said, "So you've noticed then?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Somebody must have knocked it over." And he said, "Oh, no." He said, "I thought you were getting too cocky, so I gave it a thump." And I'm afraid there was rather a lot of that in the old days. But anyway, Mr. Whitehead has gone to his maker, but the funny thing is, I remember him, and the people who were taught by him remember him very well indeed. We probably remember more about him than all the nice people who said things to us later on. But I don't know. One makes the best of whatever training you have. But it's really up to you in the end, whether you have sort of something special about you which drives you on. You have no choice, actually. But the interesting thing, there have been quite a few really extraordinary artists emerging from the Isle of Man in the last few 20 years. And not only native-born Manxmen, but I mean, John Davis, who is probably one of the most extraordinary figurative sculptors alive today, went to King William's College. And Michael Sandel, for instance, the most excellent artist, now living in Germany and gaining an increasingly massive reputation, are only two. And I think many others are emerging. And I'm looking forward to seeing one day an exhibition of Manx artists, not just one or two, but perhaps we could really put on a show for you that would knock you in the aisles. Hope so, anyway. But there's lots to be done. Anyway, thank you very much, anyhow.